Hey, everybody, and welcome to ABA Inside Track, the podcast that's like reading in your car, but safer. I'm your host, Robert Perry Cruz, and with me, as always, are my fabulous co-hosts.
Hey, Rob, it's me, Diana.
And it's me, Jackie, eating a Fun Dip piece of candy.
Delicious. Well, everybody, you are listening to ABA Inside Track, a podcast where we talk about behavior analytic research. This is episode 30, where we will be talking about prompting. If you're new to the show, you just think I have really sexy bass voice. But if you are a current listener, I don't sound like Kermit the Frog because I'm a little under the weather today. So apologies for sounding kind of stupid.
I think you sound like an operator.
From being green in your last episode.
Yeah. Yeah, I went green. I used all biodegradable items, and now I'm sick.
No, now you're like Kermit.
I don't sound like Kermit.
Oh, normally you sound like Kermit.
More normally I sound like Kermit. I've got like a...
Hi-ho, it's Rob here.
That's not me. What? Where'd I come from? That's not today. Today I just sound like Stuffy the Bear.
I'm sorry you're sick.
You should be. I blame you.
I'm not.
You're not sorry I'm sick? Thanks.
Nope. I want everyone to be sick. Get it all out, because then it'll be spring. Everyone will be like, yeah, I got all my winter sickness out.
Mm.
And then we won't be sick again.
I don't get sick very often, and I'm really bad at being sick, so.
I can see that.
Yeah. Diana told me I ran out of my bad of being sick today. Everyone was tired of it, she said.
Aww. It's like day three. This.
Well, in any case, today we're going to be talking about research related to prompting. You all use prompting, don't you?
I do.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
You kind of have to. Well, if you need to learn new things, you have to have a way to teach people those new things. And generally that's done through a combination of prompting and reinforcement.
That's true.
That is really true. Even in typically a developing population, if you're going to teach a kid skills, you may use some modeling. But if that's not sufficient, then you would help them through it, you know, by giving them gestures or verbal prompts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, any type of instruction.
Right.
Could be viewed as a prompt.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Cha-ching!
If you're just going to wait around for a response induction,
that's awesome.
And you're probably going to be waiting a long time.
Forever.
Yeah.
What are your all favorite prompts?
My favorite prompt overall, I really love the verbal prompt because I like how, I like the most least verbal prompt because I like that sometimes you're like, balloon, I like that. And
that
then,
last one was just the inquisitive look,
yeah,
that Jackie did.
That's
you couldn't see it.
That's my most favorite one. Like, you know you want to say something. That's my most favorite. Like, ooh, expectant eye gaze.
That's what it is. Expectant look.
Yeah. That's my most favorite. But I do like it when it's like, blah, blah, blah. Like, and so if you did that to like anyone, like an adult, they'd be like, what are you doing?
Right. Sometimes I use the partial verbal on my kids and they look at me like, what was that?
It's a bit condescending.
Did you just, like,
when you start doing
a stroke
that
in the middle of your
say
word.
Blah.
Yeah.
How about you, Diana?
I think that my favorite is one that I don't really prescribe that much, and it's my favorite because I think we should use it more, which is the model prompt.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you just need to show kids what to do, and then they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much easier than trying to manually guide through a task.
Yes.
Because often, if you're manually guiding through a task, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more, there's no response needed on the part of the child, and they may not be paying attention at all to what they're being guided through.
There are a lot of those on YouTube of the adult prompting the child through something while the kid's sort of
looking
staring
away
off into space. And
yeah.
They're just like, look, I'm manually guiding you to do
exactly
a puzzle.
And they're like, if I just tolerate this manual guidance, it'll be over soon and I'll get my reinforcer.
What skill did you learn today? Just wait.
How to tolerate manual guidance.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I really like the model prompt for that reason. You have to look, you have to observe, and then you have to do.
Mm. That's a good one. Excellent.
What about you?
Oh, thank you for asking. I didn't think you were going to. I like a good graduated guidance myself.
Oh, it's hard to teach.
I was going to say, it's hard to implement.
How so?
People just get that wrong a lot.
Oh, no, yes. Oh, okay, I understand. I thought you meant in terms of its utility, and I was going to feel really stupid.
No.
I use it on everyone.
No, I think people shy away from it because it's so difficult to get right on the part of the teacher.
Oh, I spent like a good month practicing graduated guidance and setting up graduated guidance training and drilling graduated guidance into staff members so that they would use it correctly.
Did you staple it right to them?
I used tag teaching, but I used an air horn instead of a tag clicker.
Did that work?
And I used a verbal wrong! It's wrong! You're wrong!
Everyone loves you at your job.
I love to use graduated guidance, you know, to teach the children. With adults, I'd love any sort of, you know, screaming method is always good.
That's great.
And that's why I'm sick now. So cool. That's my fave. That's my fave. And today we're going to be talking about two studies which do what I think we all love, which is, hey, let's take a bunch of ideas that everybody uses and let's pit them up against each other. And only one will win.
So when you say this, I always think of that toy that's like a ring. It's like a wrestling ring, but there's like a blue wrestling guy.
Oh, Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
Yeah, blue guy, red guy, and then you're just like... Pow, 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 pow.
And one of their heads will pop off.
Yep. This is what's happening in these two studies.
It's like a research...
I think of Two Men Enter.
It's a research Thunderdome.
Yeah, Thunderdome, yes.
Wow.
Two prompting methods enter. One prompting method leaves. We don't need another prompting method.
Whoa. And who said prompting wasn't fun? Wow.
Not us.
I'm cured. Thank you, Tina Turner. So we'll be talking about two articles. A comparison of most to least and least to most prompting on the acquisition of solitary play skills by Libby, Weiss, Bancroft, and Ahern from Behavior Analysis and Practice in 2008. And our second article, a comparison of simultaneous prompting and no prompting in two-choice discrimination learning with children with autism by Leaf, Sheldon, and Sherman from the Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis 2010.
Is this the same Sherman that did the "you have the right to take a nap and eat too many donuts"?
I gotta look that up.
I don't know.
Okay. I don't think it's the same guy.
I don't think it is either.
I also don't think this is the same Leaf as Leaf and McKechnie, 1993.
Or Leaf Erikson.
Not spelled differently. He's a Viking.
Well,
he did
anyway.
No research.
Cool.
Anywho.
Anyhow.
Do you think this is the same Sheldon from Happy Acres on the Garfield show?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, at least we know that.
Yeah. I definitely do.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory.
Me too, actually.
To make a reference that, you know, it's from this century.
No, I would say his catchphrase, but I've never seen that show.
Me neither.
Does he have a catchphrase? Did I do that?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. You got it.
That's actually Family Matters, Steve Urkel.
Oh, darn it.
Anyway.
TGIF the 90s, Diana.
Yeah, that came on right after Step by Step.
You sure did. Ooh, baby.
I think you're wrong, Diana. Step by Step was a 9. Family Matters came after Full House.
Oh, it's true, actually.
Where did Boy Meets World come in there?
Every day on the Disney Channel.
It was when they had a different rotation of TGIF. I stopped watching at that point.
I didn't. I love Boy Meets World.
I did, too.
When I'm sick, this is the last thing, and then we'll really go into the article. When I was sick now, it's usually on ABC Family, or now what it's called, Freeform. Whatever.
Oh, yeah?
And it's on at 9 to 9:30. And if ever I'm sick or I'm, like, not left work yet, I'm like... Well, I can't leave now. Boy Meets World is
on. I know what happens to Ryder.
And Topanga.
What was it? Oh, yeah. Topanga.
That's Topanga.
I actually watch Girl Meets World now on the Disney Channel.
Is it? It's a sequel?
Is that of the same caliber?
No. It's not on the same caliber, but it is a sequel. Topanga and boy. I can't remember
Corey?
His name. Corey. They got married, have a kid, and it's the kid. It's a girl.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Spoiler. On the Disney Channel.
Is Mr. Feeny still there?
Yes.
Oh, my God. That guy must be so old.
He's so old. Yeah.
Do you know, piece of trivia, Mr. Feeny played the voice of Kit the Car from Knight Rider.
That's really special.
Knight Rider.
Thank you for sharing.
With David Hasselhoff playing at your movie theater Friday. Who's going first today?
Me.
All right, Jaggy, you go.
Me. I'm going to talk about the Libby article on prompting with the acquisition of solitary play skills.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
It's a bit inside baseball. Was this related to research similar to that was done? I don't know if it's the exact same group, but they looked at prompting methods for task analyses?
Yes.
Okay.
Same group. Same group. Research group. It's called the TA Research Group.
Okay.
Yeah.
Real creative name.
Yep. They really hit the ball out of the park with that name.
No, I just remember because Julie did a presentation on the TAs for a group.
Yes.
I was in a while back, and I remember I still tell people that, and they go, "Where'd you learn about this?" I'm like, "Well, Julie Weiss, of course." And they shut up. They don't even know if that's a real person. I just if you say a name and someone asks you about research, you probably know more than they do.
Brenda. Brenda taught it to me.
This article has the picture of the famed Lego constructs in there. So you know it's part of the same research group.
So what they were looking at here is how we can efficiently and effectively teach behavior chains. One thing I love about this article is that they give definitions for everything. They're like, a behavior chain is a sequence of responses leading to a terminal behavior. Objective. So that's like pretty helpful, right? Because sometimes we use the word, but we don't really talk about it. Yeah. And then they're like, effective. This is what effective means.
It did.
If the skills are learned. Efficient. If they learned it quickly with minimal errors. I like that. So the introduction was very thorough and gave some good definitions of commonly used words that we don't necessarily always define. Yeah.
I think that was kind of nice. I think it was, you know, related to being published in BAP.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the audience is more for clinicians that may need a refresher or not.
I don't know if that population really does.
No, they probably don't. But I like the refresher always.
Mm.
I need a refresher.
Yeah, it was kind of nice.
They wanted to teach play skills, so they chose Lego constructs because you can make them of equal difficulty and you can make arbitrary sets so that you know that the students have never built these before. And, you know.
Yeah, they're almost like a metaphor for a play skill.
Right.
Right.
They kind of are, right? But I mean.
It's the proto play skill.
If you're going to pick a play skill that's ubiquitous. God, I love using that word.
Mm.
Building things with Legos. I mean, all kids except for me built things with Legos at some point.
And it scales up with age to still be relatively age appropriate, even for older kids, which I do like that a lot.
Yeah.
And they do have a big assortment of Lego subsets, you know. So if you're a kid and you like Star Wars or you like superheroes or you like just building or Minecraft, I mean, all the kids love Minecraft these days.
That they have Lego Minecraft.
You've got those sets. So even if you're not big on Legos, you might be big on one of those brands, and then maybe I'll try out this Lego because I can make a spaceship or I can make a Minecraft house.
Right. I think one common limitation that we've talked about, though, when looking at this type of research is that the Legos, even though it's, you know, functionally appropriate, it still is fairly arbitrary, right? So it's like some weird structure. If you look, they don't really look like anything.
Yeah.
They're just kind of creepy blocks on top of one another.
You can make it look like a house.
Kind of like
a shoe.
Right. But most of them don't really look like anything. No. That's something that when I've talked about this article in the past, that's one of the criticisms that people bring up is that if I saw a kid building those constructs, those arbitrary constructs, I'm like, what are you building? Right?
Right.
So.
But this is a research article.
It is a research article. Yeah, it's true.
Things like, what is the difficulty of these Lego sets?
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think when you're looking at it in terms of the seven dimensions, we're supposed to make it, is it a problem? And can we make it sure that it's going to be socially significant for the individual? I mean, yeah, building Legos is, but building arbitrary construction things may not be.
Yeah.
So that's just
next step.
Yeah, next step is
take it and
up.
Find like equal Minecraft and Star Wars Lego sets.
Right.
And then see if it still applies.
Yeah. But regardless.
I have to say, though, we were at Target and my son saw a Minecraft Lego set and it says on there, like, build in multiple ways. And he's like, oh, this set you can make into anything you want.
Oh, that's awesome.
Like, oh, all Legos you can really make into anything.
That's
because
I've been telling him not to take them out of the bags. We've organized them in by their genre of Lego. Mm, and I think
I found the problem.
Yeah, it's actually kind of awesome. But I think, you know, the foundation or the crux of the article, looking at the different prompting procedures, is very valid, very socially valid, and something that we need to know about.
Mm-hmm.
So what they wanted to look at is the physical prompts that we use typically to teach behavior chains. So, you know, there's two big ones, right? The most to least prompting and the least to most prompting. And then sometimes, you know, you get a little crazy and throw in a time delay in there.
Mm-hmm.
But most to least, usually you start more intrusive, doing some hand over hand, gradually move up the arm. Sometimes you add in that late touch and shadow, which I love watching. You know, it's like taboo.
Yeah.
I'm not touching you.
But I kind of am. Yeah, I used to do that to my sister to annoy her. But then the least and most, one nice thing about that is that you're giving the child the opportunity, you know, to do the skill.
Yeah. I want to, in the interest of full disclosure, I just want to let you guys know I hate least to most prompting.
You do. I love
it. I hate it. I think it's sloppy and...
It is sloppy, but
that's why you like graduated guidance.
Yeah, well, graduated guidance, I feel like, takes some of the positives of, mm-hmm. of most to least and least to most mm-hmm. in there. So, well, I mean, you know, spoiler alert, they do a little bit looking at how to sort of make each prompt take the best components of the other type of prompt. But I just wanted to let everyone know, I went into this with real bias. I was hoping least to most would lose and lose hard.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
This total WWE SmackDown?
I wanted them to be sent to the wasteland, never to return, but... We'll see if that happens, I guess.
Okay. So they wanted to just look to see which one would be faster, which one would be more efficient and effective.
Right.
Yeah. So the study had 5 participants. And one interesting thing, which I may posit could be a limitation, is that they use forward chaining for all the participants. Mm. Because we have read previous research suggesting that some children learn better with backward chaining or total task versus forward chain. So this could be a limitation because we don't have the history of these students. Mm. So that's when I was reading. I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
But everyone's doing it the same for prompting sync. But it would have made the study stronger if they had said, you know, and an assessment was done to unequivocally state that all these children learn better with forward chains.
Yeah. And they did teacher complete.
Yeah.
As well, which is also kind of unusual.
Yeah, that is pretty that is unusual. So what they did is they had 4 different constructs for each student. They did a multi-element design. Each construct was built with one of the prompts.
Yeah, so they all had like a base plate.
Yep.
Right? Oh yeah, it's base like size plate. Of like half a sheet of paper, and they're Duplos.
I never played Legos, so
my mom missed out, man.
No, I really did.
So they had like a base plate that was about the size of half a sheet of paper, right?
Yeah.
And then the construct was built on top of it, maybe like 10 different.
It was an 8-step chain.
8 steps. Okay.
Yeah, and you can actually go and view the task analysis on the ABAI website. If you go to abaiinternational.org/BA in practice.
Cool.
.asp. You can see the task analysis and follow along.
Ooh.
Yeah.
You too could build an arbitrary design.
Yeah. So they used a least to most. They had independent, light touch, shadow, manual guidance at upper arm, manual guidance at forearm, and then hand over hand, and a most to least, hand over hand, manual guidance at forearm, manual guidance at upper arm, light touch and shadow, and independent. They start each session by saying, let's play. And then they just built the Legos with whatever prompting design that they used. And they had the same sort of error correction procedure for each of them. And when to move up or down steps, that was all fairly similar.
Mm-hmm.
Mastery criteria was the same for each of them. And any errors were fixed with hand-over-hand guidance. And so what they wanted to look at is to see how many sessions it took to acquire the skills in most to least and least to most, and how many errors per session. And what was pretty cool, I think, is that it took the kids less time to complete the Legos using least to most, but they made more errors.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty interesting.
Well, they had the opportunity to make more errors.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So if you have a student that does not like making errors, that might be problematic. I had a student that anytime you said no or try again, he would flip the table and punch you in the face.
Mm-hmm.
So
we should talk about him with my article then.
Yeah. So we never really gave him the opportunity. We used most of the least until the end. Yeah. Yeah. He'd be like, try again! And then flip the table. Yeah.
Oh, man.
So that was pretty interesting that they found those results. And for 2 of the 5 participants, they switched over to most to least to actually acquire the skills. So they weren't acquiring the skills on least to most, and then they switched over to most to least, and then the skills were acquired.
All right.
Yeah.
There you go then.
Yeah. So then they also showed that 2 of the 5 participants showed that most to least was more effective and efficient. So both faster and better. Faster and better.
New and improved.
Yeah, right? But then I think it was pretty cool that they then did study 2. Where they added a most to least with a delay.
Right.
So maybe it was that most to least was taking longer because you didn't give the student the opportunity. But if you add this delay in, then the student then gets the opportunity. But they also get the prompt if they need it.
Yeah, because they made the point that with most to least, there were 8 sessions minimally before the student even had an opportunity to respond independently.
Yeah. And so what they did find is that all of the participants acquired the Legos during least to most faster again.
Mm-hmm.
But most to least was just as effective with least to most, with fewer errors. Yeah. And one other thing I like is that they did generalization probes following the training, and the skills were acquired as well. So that was nice. They didn't just train and then they're like, we're done, and throw the papers in the air.
We're out.
And one thing I love about this study and how they wrote it is that I think it's well laid out, but then at the end they give you these little like clinical bullets. Like,
mm-hmm.
I like that so much. Like, here's some recommendation. Most at least with the time today is likely the best default response. It's preferable if errors have been found to impede a child's learning or increase problem behavior. But least to most can be used if students show rapid acquisition. So they kind of gave us like golden nuggets at the end that we could kind of glean from if we need to use this for clinical purposes.
I know Dorothea Lehrman did a nice talk and has published a couple sort of best practice guidelines, you know, so mm-hmm. how do you take this research? Because, again, we have lots of folks, and especially people who are listening to this show, where they're reading the research, they're trying to keep up, but it doesn't always lend itself to, oh, now that I've read this research, I know exactly what to do at all times. And sometimes it's nice to just be able to say, no, here's 30 articles that specifically talked about this. Here's what you should do to start. You probably, you have to be smart about it. You can't just, nope, everybody gets this prompt and I'll never change it. But given no information, sort of like they posit in the article, do this. And then if you find this other problem, this might be the next one you want to try. So start with your most to least with a 2-second delay. And especially if the kids you're working with hate making errors. And then you can go from there. You can decide what works best for that student.
Yeah.
And I like having that. As someone who does more practice than I do research, it's so nice. As much as I like to feel smart, because I read the research myself, and it's nice to just have someone be like, here's the piece of paper that tells you what to do, and you'll be a good person.
I like that too, and I... And I do research as well. So I read the research, but I still like that, I actually got what I was supposed to get out of that article.
Well, it's like, would you rather go foraging through the forest for berries that are scattered among a whole bunch of different shrubs? Or would you like to just pick up the basket of pre-foraged berries that's just waiting on the edge of the forest?
That's going to depend on how adventurous you are.
That's true. Sometimes the journey is really what matters.
Yeah.
No, in this case, the journey is not what matters.
It's a crap forest. You don't want to go in there.
It's all those wonderful results just waiting for you in that basket that someone... That's what the meta-analysis is. You know? They've already...
Calm down.
I'm so excited. Knocking things over. They've already foraged the berries for you, and they're just waiting there. Sorted and classified.
Yeah. One thing they do note, though, is that although I think that these results do have generality. The participants were all in one residential facility at one school. There wasn't really a lot of spreading out. They were all the same age.
Do they talk about their history with regard to prompting strategies? Because that would be interesting to know, too. Like, have they had most to least their whole life?
Mm-hmm.
No, they just say that they're participants. They have a diagnosis of autism. They're between the ages of 9 and 15. They all live in the same residential facility. But this may not work.
They love to build Legos.
Right. And they love to build Legos. Maybe. Maybe now they hate Legos.
To building all these arbitrary designs.
Right. But this is a good starting point, I think, for someone that's like, oh no, where do I start? So,
right.
Maybe a new budding behavior analyst. Don't just do something you've done before just because you did it before, but maybe look through the research and say, okay, this is what this article is suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
when you're getting a new student on your caseload.
Yeah.
That you don't know anything about their learning history or how they've been taught in the past.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good way to go. It's most to least with a 2-second prompt delay. And then as you get to know them, you can always make changes.
Which you should, because we are a field of individualization.
Exactly.
Totally.
Neat.
All right, everybody. Everybody, no, thanks, Jackie. We didn't do anything. We did all the talking.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks, Jack.
Thanks, expectant luck.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with our second article.
With your friends behind the bleed. she's gonna be there in the high school gym. And it's almost...
Hey, ABA Inside Trackers. Are you interested in being a behavior analyst and you're not yet? If so, I really would recommend looking into the Regis College Master's in Science and Applied Behavior Analysis program. Our 2016 pass rates for first-time test takers of the BCBA exam was 90%. We think this is a true testament to our program. In addition, we're going to be starting an on-campus autism center in the summer of 2017. This is going to allow our graduate students on-hands learning right at our college, and you will receive partial tuition remission if you work at the center, which is pretty amazing. We also offer paid clinical placements and graduate assistantships starting in our students' first year, where all of our grad students are working in the field either part-time or full-time. I find you that job. That is part of my job. We also are approved by the BACB to provide intensive practicum, so students will complete 750 hours of an intensive practicum across their time at Regis. All of our faculty are PhD-level BCBAs with strong applied and research backgrounds in ABA, and all have published papers in respected peer-reviewed journals. We ensure small class sizes so that all students receive personalized attention from their professors and advisors, are easily accessible to meet with students. Two more really great things that I want to highlight about the Regis program is that we host an invited lecture series at Regis each year, which involves inviting outside experts in ABA to speak on specialized topics relating to practicing ABA. Last summer, we completed an international service trip to Iceland. This trip enables students to learn more about providing culturally competent care to diverse populations. Students and alums work with children diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder and provided parent and teacher trainings for 11 days. This service trip occurs every other year, and the next trip will be in the summer of 2018. And finally, we have a great location. We're just 12 miles from the center of Boston. We currently have rolling admission. We're accepting students into a Reach capacity for the fall of 2017. Please check us out at www.regiscollege.edu.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, and we are back here at ABA Inside Track with our next exciting article. Diana, you're going to take us into the wild and woolly world of the no-no prompt.
No-no.
No-no.
No-no prompt means no-no.
So, spoiler alert, these results surprised me.
Yeah, they totally surprised
me. How is that a spoiler? We don't know what your thought process was on
this. That's true, but my last one wasn't that surprised.
Right.
Mm. But this one, I was like, what?
I did not expect this at all.
Me neither. But I'm glad I read it, because then I love having a little suspense and surprise in my life.
Studies like this always do make me feel like I'm a good behavior analyst because I'm looking at the results and not making a statement and saying I refuse to accept them because I have a preconceived notion about prompting hierarchies.
Yeah, I know. It, like,
which
totally,
I do, I was but like, I didn't
oh,
want to.
Man, I guess I should be thinking about this more. So I'm excited to bring this article to our audience so they can also think about this.
Yes. But Diana, before we get into that second article, I did want to let our listeners know, if you're new to the show or if you've listened before, ABA Inside Track is actually a continuing education provider source. So all you need to do is listen to the episode with rapt attention and pick out our two secret code words. And then you can click a link and send them to us so we know that you listened to the whole darn thing. All right. So our first keyword is interceptor. Diana, please spell that for me because you wrote it down.
Can you use it in a sentence, please?
This is the last of the V8 interceptors in Thunderdome.
Interceptor. I-N-T-E-R-C-E-P-T-O-R. Interceptor.
Interceptor. Now playing. All right. And then actually, before we go, Jackie, you had done some research while we were taking our break, and you noted we made a mistake, so you can't send it in and tell us we were wrong.
I've errated myself. Is when we were talking about this study that Diana's going to talk about, we saw that there was a Sheldon and a Sherman as authors, and I wondered if they were the same people that wrote the Balancing the Right to Rehabilitation with the Right to Personal Liberties, the rights of people with developmental disabilities to eat too many donuts and take a nap. And it is the same people. So I find that crazy because I thought one of them was a lawyer, but I guess maybe not. Who knows? But maybe nice. One of them is a lawyer.
Perhaps.
But yeah, so those are the same people.
Thanks for doing that background work.
Welcome. You know, it was hard work. I had to put my hair in a small ash ponytail.
I love it. It's real cute.
Yeah. First time. First time for everything.
I was worried we were going to look
real
dumb.
It's like a little pebbles ponytail.
It is.
All right, you ready?
I'm ready. Okay, that's enough of this. You go on, girl.
All right, so Leaf, Sheldon, and Sherman compared two types of prompting for skill acquisition: simultaneous prompting and no-no prompting. I didn't know either of these terms, really, before this article.
No, I didn't either.
No.
I knew simultaneous prompting, and I've heard of no-no prompting.
Initially, I thought it was like go, no go.
That's different.
That's a different thing.
That's like a space thing.
No.
That's just because we just saw Hidden Figures. It's not. Okay. It's not just a space thing.
It wasn't
that's a different
case.
Thing entirely, and we'll have to talk about it another time. But this simultaneous prompting just means providing a prompt immediately following the SD that's going to control responding by indicating the correct response. And it could take many different forms: vocal, gestural, model, etc. But it's going to happen right away. So it's not a delayed prompt. It's just an immediate prompt. I feel like it falls into the territory of errorless teaching, but it's an immediate prompt. So that's simultaneous prompting. And they were comparing that to the no-no prompt.
No-no. No.
And I was like, what the heck does that mean? But what it means is that using this type of prompting, you're going to provide the opportunity for the individual to respond independently first. If they make an error, you're going to say neutrally no or try again.
Man, can you imagine?
Your friend
would be dead.
No.
Yeah, your friend isn't. That's not a good fit.
Try again.
Right. Remove the stimuli, represent. Allow the opportunity for independent response again. If an error occurs again, you're going to say no.
No.
Or try again.
Try again.
And then when you represent it the third time, you're going to present the controlling prompt that will promote or evoke correct response.
So that last part is the exact same as the simultaneous prompting.
Yeah. So there's two tries before that.
Right.
There's not a lot of research on the no-no prompt outside of larger treatment packages, so they really wanted to look at it pulled out independently and compared in a head-to-head against simultaneous prompting.
Right, because there's some differences. You know, the rates of prompting are different. The rates of reinforcement are different.
Yep, exactly. There's less prompting with the no-no prompt, and there's also less reinforcement.
Right.
Unless you are getting 100% right out of the gate, in which case you probably don't need to learn this skill. So those are different, and we'll talk about those more. There were three participants in this study. They were all young learners. Brady was 5. He spoke in full sentences. Ashley was 3. She had no expressive language. And Jeremy was 4, and he also spoke in complete sentences. And everyone had an autism diagnosis.
Autism spectrum diagnosis.
Excuse me. Okay, so they did several things here. The first thing they did was a toy preference assessment. It was a paired stimulus preference assessment. And I, for one, appreciated that it was toys that they used and not edible reinforcement.
Me too.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. More socially acceptable, less stigmatizing.
Yeah, like everything
healthier.
Doesn't have to be edibles.
Right.
And once you introduce edibles,
you can never go back.
Not really going back. So I loved that. For these are little guys. They like toys. Let's keep it appropriate for them. The next thing they did was decide what skills to target. These were chosen just based on what the students were typically working on. They needed 6 sets of 2 stimuli. This is an important point to make. This was just a 2 choice comparison that they were doing here. So they included things like what is 1+5 as one of the comparisons and what is 3+4 as the other comparison. The SD was which one adds up to 6, which one adds up to 7. That was for Brady. Ashley was just doing a receptive ID discrimination between simple household items like cup or spoon.
Or dog.
And Jeremy, his were more complex receptive ID, like red light and green light, things a little bit like that. So everyone had 6 sets of those.
They're WH questions, though, right? They were.
Yeah, he also had WH questions.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Well, I thought that was like, which one means stop or?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, I forgot that detail. So they determined what those were going to be. They then did a controlling prompt assessment, where they provided four different types of prompts, including a positional prompt, so like one of the correct stimulus would be closer, perhaps, or highlighted in some way, a model prompt, in which they modeled the correct response, a gestural prompt, in which they pointed to the correct response, a full physical prompt, in which they manually guided the correct response, and they looked to see under which controlling prompt responding occurred.
With 100% accuracy.
With 100% accuracy.
With Japanese letters.
Yeah. Kanji.
Yeah.
So there's no chance that these guys knew that. So yeah. For Jeremy, the gestural prompt worked better. And then for Brady and Ashley, the full physical prompt worked better. So that's what they used. And then, after all of that was out of the way, they finally got to move into the actual treatment. But of course, before they did that, they needed to do some probe. So throughout this study, there were opportunities for full probe, which was probing all six sets of stimuli that were either in training or going to be trained, as well as daily probe, in which they just probed the stimuli that were going to be trained for that day. There was no prompting or reinforcement provided during the probe sessions. So once those were done, they ran their comparison between the no-no prompting and the simultaneous prompting. Each of two sets of stimuli were assigned to that condition, and they ran them out pretty much how we've already discussed. So the simultaneous prompting, an immediate prompt was provided. Whether the response occurred independently or with prompting, reinforcement was delivered. And then with the no-no prompt, they did it just how I laid out before. If they got it wrong, they said no. If they got it wrong again, they said no. And then they provided the prompt. One thing I noticed while I was reading this, and this might help you guys remember this too, is that the name no-no prompt is the treatment.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I was like, why is it
you
no,
say no? Then you prompt.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yes. Like, no, no.
Clever.
It's like in Jurassic Park. We're like,
You
didn't say the magic word. Because I was like, that's kind of a weird way to name it. But then I realized it's actually a description of what you do. Yeah.
Yeah, I really spent the whole article going, when are they going to go, no, no.
No, no.
No, no.
No, 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 no.
No, no.
Yeah. I'm glad they don't do that, because that would really make me hate this.
We chose this condescending prompt for children.
Exactly.
I wonder if it works.
So they compared between those two, and they did this three different times. So once the first set was trained, they did the full probe again across all sets. Then they moved to the next set of two stimuli. They did the probe again across all sets. And then finally to the last set. So there was replication within each participant as well. And then at the end of everything, throughout the whole study, they had been using color-coded placemats.
Yep.
For the probe condition was blue, the no-no prompt was red, and then the simultaneous prompt was yellow. So those were present underneath the stimuli. And every third session, they presented the red and the yellow placemats together and said, which one of these, you know, work tasks would you like to do first today? So they could choose. So at the end of everything, they went back and analyzed what those preference assessment data looked like for the different prompting conditions too, which was nice. We've talked about that before, that I love the inclusion of that. All right. The DV, correct responding, and prompted responding. Jackie, they had some nice PI data.
They did.
Procedural integrity, which is critical.
Right.
You can't have the study without having procedural integrity data.
Mm-hmm.
So they looked at how well the experimenter implemented the simultaneous and the no-no prompt. Guess what? They did great.
They did great.
I know you're shocked. And then they also threw in there what kind of design this was.
Yeah.
It was a parallel treatments design.
What is a parallel treatments design? Because I had never heard, that I can remember, heard of this design.
It's not super common. So
no.
You can find it in a book by Campbell and Stanley.
What's that book called? Oh, okay. Experimental Design.
Yeah, I think it's called Experimental Design.
It's like the plainest Janish book.
Right. And it's white with blue lettering.
Yep, exactly.
And it's
Do you know that I saw a copy of Strunk and White the other day that has a basset hound on the cover?
I have that one.
I love that. Like, why'd they choose a basset hound?
Oh, because the whole thing is pictures in the inside. I'll show it to you.
Yeah, I didn't open it.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty. I have it.
Okay. Will you buy me one for my birthday?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't buy anything for your birthday this year. Oh, I did, actually.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, I did. So next year.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Also, they talk about the parallel treatments design with Gast and Woolery in 1988. So what it is, it's just a way that you can look at two instructional strategies or two instructional procedures in a multiple probe design. So across multiple, either multiple participants, in this case, multiple pairs. This is what it's used for. And they suggest that it controls for all the extraneous variables because it's happening concurrently. It would control for instructor, time of day, any other stimuli, because it's all happening at the same time.
Yeah. They defined it as comparing the effects of two or more independent variables on different dependent variables. I hadn't really heard of this either. I, in the past, have used an adapted alternating treatments design for this type of work, where you're looking at two different skill acquisition programs. Mm-hmm. But as you can imagine, you can't use the same stimuli if you're making a comparison across two different types of prompting or any modification there, because you don't know which one would produce learning. So you need to compare across hopefully relatively well equated sets of stimuli. So the adapted alternating treatments design works well in that regard too, because you can be running concurrent acquisition for two sets of stimuli, generally with perhaps an initial probe or initial baseline as well. So I'm not sure how these might look differently. Maybe that this one has kind of like a multiple baseline built into it, and that you're doing it across multiple sets.
It's a multiple probe built into it, and it has to be running concurrently. So each pair has to be running the same session across multiple pair sets. So it's that multiple
pair sets.
Yeah.
Which is a nice addition.
Yeah, it is. And it appears when you look at the literature review on parallel treatments, it's only been used with investigating response prompts. And prompting.
Oh.
Yeah, so.
All right. Might be time to dredge it up, guys.
Yeah.
Bring it back to life.
Hmm? Like an old typeface.
Yeah, it's got the same guidelines.
Sure, or a zombie. I mean, that's what I was going to say. Maybe a little less subtle of a metaphor.
Yeah.
It's got the same guidelines as a multiple probe design, but it's not only a multiple probe design. Because you're running concurrent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So now we know. All about that. I'm ready to talk about results.
Me too.
Are you guys ready to hear about results?
I am ready.
Are you sure?
Blow my mind.
I'm going to. Except that you already read it. But
who will be sent to the wasteland?
I did not predict what was about to happen.
Nor I.
All right. All three participants. So remember, they were trying to teach three sets of two stimuli in the no-no prompt and three sets of two stimuli in the simultaneous prompt for each participant. All three participants mastered all stimuli using the no-no prompt. Brady mastered one set of stimuli using the simultaneous prompt. Ashley and Jeremy mastered no stimuli using the simultaneous prompt.
That's ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. It's amazing. I did not see that coming.
How does anybody learn anything? Because everybody uses simultaneous prompting.
Right?
Because I heard the no-no prompt. I was like, that sounds like a prompt for people who don't know what they're doing and just are like, no, do it again. No, do it again.
Right.
No, do it again.
Right.
You know,
oh, you're building in errors. Teachers. You're building in errors. Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Oh, no.
I don't believe it.
The Tasmanian devil has joined us. I was shocked.
Big no-no had their hand in this, I think.
Big no-no.
Big no-no company.
All right. Additionally, over the course of these three comparisons, the number of teaching trials for the no-no prompt decreased over time for both Brady and Ashley, meaning that they needed fewer trials to reach mastery for sets two and three, indicating additional, perhaps, learning was occurring. Not the case for Jeremy, but was true for the other two. And when we got to the preference assessment, that part was more mixed. Brady clearly preferred the no-no prompt. Jeremy clearly preferred the simultaneous prompt. Ashley did not appear to have a clear preference for either. So that part, if that piece had shown that everyone liked the no-no prompt, I would have thought these data were made up. Right?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I actually can see that the utility of the no-no prompt, because you're building in conditional discriminations, right? So we learn by making errors in the real world,
mm-hmm.
right? So I wouldn't recommend this as the first prompting procedure, but I can see its utility by exposing individuals to errors so that they can learn from their mistakes, in a sense, and, you know, contact both the non-reinforcing contingency as well as the reinforcing contingency.
I always thought that was such a platitude, though. Oh, we learn by making mistakes. Plenty of people make mistakes, and they never change their behavior, ever.
Well, that's because they're not sensitive to the contingencies at play. But here,
it's only a mistaken name.
Right.
The reinforcement is continuing right. for their error.
Yeah, right? So here, in this case...
The pigeon knows best, Rob.
Yeah.
Theoretically, they would be learning based on if no yeah. was aversive.
So they lay out some reasons why they think this might yeah. have happened. And I think that I really liked the discussion of this article because they make some really good points, both for the results that they found and reasons why the results they found might be limited to this type of study. So first they talked about why do they think this happened. I don't know if they were as shocked as we were, but maybe they were.
I don't think they were.
Oh, no?
No.
Just me?
Yeah.
Okay, they really sat down and were like, you know what? This prompt's probably going
to
be
well,
the
because
best prompt.
We're all, like, to be fair, we all come from the same background. We're similar.
It's errorless learning all the way.
Right. Yeah. But that's not the case anywhere else in the world. I mean, there is other places, but, you know, when you...
Like Montessori school?
No. I'm saying, like, other places that run behavior analytic programs, not everyone uses errorless learning. In fact, based on kind of just going around the world looking at what people are doing on my previous job, which shall rename nameless, there's a lot of crazy prompting going on that's not what we do.
Good to know.
Yeah. So I think they probably were not surprised.
Let's get
a point I'm going to save for dissemination stage.
Sure, yeah.
Let's get to the why.
Okay. So the first point that they made is a biggie. Using no-no prompting provided differential consequences, differential
yeah.
reinforcement for independent and correct response. That was not the case with simultaneous prompting. And I don't think that we can overstate the importance of differential reinforcement.
We can.
We are right now. We're yeah. overstating it. No, we're highlighting it. Okay, number two. This was only a two-choice array. So once you got it wrong, you knew the correct answer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was a good chance that these individuals were learning through exclusion.
Mm-hmm. Or that they were just learning to respond away from
True.
The S delta.
True. You hear once wrong, you say, okay, well, it must be the other one.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Although they did learn over time, and we saw them learn. So they weren't just responding after the prompt away.
But they still could have.
Initially.
But they still could have been always responding away from what was wrong before.
Mm-hmm.
So that has happened.
Because they're only paired with one another.
Yeah.
Ooh, good point. They could have probed for that.
Terrace 1963.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Finally, they pointed out that if, you know, for two of the participants for simultaneous prompting, it was just hand over hand, manual guidance. So there was no observing response or attending required by the individual in that format.
True.
So they posited that with no-no prompting, they needed to scan the array and make a response independently. And that could have also contributed to learning.
I've seen that before. Mm. How many times have you been like observing a teacher running some discrete trial program and the kids looking at the ceiling and the teacher's like, you're right, as they place the hand on the card. Like, that happens.
It does, but
it shouldn't.
It's unfortunate.
Right, but it does sometimes happen.
Yeah, that's not what we want. We want there to be active observation on the part of the child. Mm-hmm. So those are really good points. They also had some considerations here, which was, first of all, the response topography in this study was limited to pointing. So it was all really receptive identification.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter, you know, which correct response, the answer topographically for the participant was the same. So they made the point that applying this to other types of more complex and varied behavior and response topographies could be more difficult. It just hasn't been done before. So play behavior or imitation behavior or social skills behavior all required much more radically different responses on the part of the individual. So in this case, right, you hear that you made an error. You know you made an error because someone says, try again or no. So you use the same exact response and just do it to the other one. But if, for example, someone says, what's your name? And you say, I'm 5 years old. They represent the SD and they say, what's your name?
You
don't automatically know to say, my name's Diana.
There's an infinite number of responses.
Right.
Exactly. Thank
yeah.
you. That's what I'm trying to say. So it's not that they don't know if this would work with other more complex response topographies. They just hasn't been done yet. But it could be a limitation.
That seems like a huge limitation.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're not hiding it, because certainly in the, you know, their final paragraph, so we learned that the no-no prompt is more effective for two-item receptive discrimination.
You it's know, in the title, too.
They were pretty clear that this is limited to this subset of learning.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which to me, I think the way you described it, Diana, with the child who, what's your name? Blue. No. What's your name? Table.
Ooh, right.
Oh, sorry. Of all the choices, the odds were not in your favor.
Right.
You were going to guess right on that one.
Well, it seems that this may actually make the child prompt dependent, right? Because they have to wait for that prompt.
Keep talking until I get the answer.
Right. It could be.
It could. I mean, like, if you think.
But
about
hopefully,
it,
differential reinforcement could alleviate some of that prompt dependency.
True.
All right. They would like to do this study with more types of participants. That's totally fair because they had three.
They were good participants, though. I really felt like they ran the gamut of, you know, simple to more complex tasks.
Yeah, but there hasn't been much research here, so definitely want to do more.
Of course.
They brought up the concern about the aversiveness of using no.
Yeah, everybody hates that.
Yeah? I don't want to be told no.
Multiple times without getting
Right. Which is, whenever I think I've read about no prompting before, I've just been like, skip, because I don't like that idea of just telling someone no and not helping them further.
I'm just imagining someone telling me, you know, I'm doing something and I'm like trying really hard to complete a task and someone goes, no. Okay, the first one I might do the sort of like, huh, okay, fine, I'll do another thing. Do it wrong again, no. Well, then what the should I be doing?
Right?
Yeah. And one thing is, do you think about the rate of learning, right? So with simultaneous prompting, at least you're going through things quickly because it's almost immediate prompt. You get it right, we're moving on. Whereas no.
You get reinforcement.
Right. So the no prompt is, you have to get it wrong twice before you get any sort of anything.
Yeah, like what is the answer?
Right. And so that may actually slow down learning, slow down the rate of acquisition and make it learning more aversive.
Yeah. It didn't.
But we're talking about the two item discrimination here. We're not talking about any other complex set of behavior where I still am very skeptical that this would be that effective. Maybe I'm being naive. I don't know.
I would love to see this replicated with a three-stim array.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Let's do it, everyone.
No one's done that since 2010?
I don't think so.
I don't know.
I did a quick literature review.
No. I mean, we did a...
Yeah.
Cursory search.
We were prepping for this. We didn't.
I didn't find it.
No.
So.
Dibs. I got dibs. Sorry, everybody.
Their point was this could be aversive. I do prefer try again at the very least.
No.
No.
There is some other no prompting by the same authors, however.
All right. We should look into that.
Yeah. 2011, 2015.
So what was the 2015 one?
Effects of no prompting on teaching expressive labeling of facial expressions to children with and without a pervasive developmental disorder, and education and training in children and developmental disabilities. But I kind of want to read it.
The title is not as descriptive.
Right. So, I mean, there is limited research on no prompting. Limited.
Yeah. We should get on that. All right. But their other point was the effectiveness that they saw with a no prompt may not be related to saying no or saying try again at all. It could just be the delay to reinforcement and the requirement to respond again.
Mm.
Right. So you might not need to say anything.
Mm.
Your frowny face. So more research needs to be done there. And then finally, they also brought up that they did not do an initial color preference assessment before they started in on their...
Mm.
treatment preference assessment based on the color placemats. So they don't know if perhaps Jeremy had a preference towards the yellow placemat, for example.
Oh, that's interesting. It's possible. We've seen it before.
It's always good to test that stuff. Remember the Slayton article where they had the green and the black and the whatever, and they tested all of those different things in their baseline to make sure there was no preferential responding. That was really well controlled. So I know that these folks were kicking themselves at the end of it when they said, oh, shoot, we didn't do that.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a limitation. That's it.
All right. Well, I think we all want to talk about prompts and what we learned about prompts today. So let's move into our final segment, Dissemination Station. Brought to you
nice
by
nice prompt you provided to
Jackie.
Thank you, I know, right?
So, we read two articles about prompting. Yep. Have they changed your mindsets about what your favorite stock prompts are?
You know, yes. I think so. I'm not going to lie. I like most to least. I really do. It'd be what I would start with first.
I like saying most, least, least, most.
But I may change my mind now. Mm-hmm. I may, based on the Libby article, even though I've read it multiple times and have never heeded its advice, I might now either do a most to least with the time delay or do a least to most initially just to see.
You said you do most to least.
I love most to least.
But just with no time delay?
Yeah.
Are you worried about treatment integrity?
No.
You just love it.
I don't know. It's like one of those things sometimes you get stuck in a rut. You're like, I'm going to do this. And I don't have a rut that I'm currently in right now. But when I think about past ruts that I have been in, meaning yeah. I'm not doing clinical work at this very moment. Mm. But when I was doing clinical work, I mostly would start with I would do most to least with the population that I was working with. But I'm wondering if maybe that was an error.
I mean, I love most to least myself, but I do like the idea of the most to least with a 2 second delay sort of being the, I don't know this kid, so let's just throw this one out there, because it does take a lot of what I like about most to least, and it does take a lot about what I like about any sort of a time delay, just the sense of potential speed that might be gained. Because I've had way too many students that I've worked with in the past that it takes, you know, a couple weeks before we realize, wow, they blow through these most to least programs. And you're saying, oh, if we'd done a 2 second yeah. delay, they would have learned two or three times as many sets of stimuli. Ah! And you course correct. But, you know, I think a lot of the kids that were successful with just most to least as is would still have been successful with most to least 2 second delay. Maybe not.
Or least to most.
Or least to most.
They're probably quick learners.
But the student, but if everyone sort of, because again, you brought up, Diana, the treatment integrity piece. I worry with least to most. I've worked with too many people who are very, very good, but without constant supervision would turn least to most into error, 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 ineffectual prompt, ineffectual prompt, ineffectual prompt. Eventually they'd get to it.
At the end of the day, it's just plus or plus P.
That's true, but I, you know, what exactly, when you have least to most, you know, do people follow that hierarchy? I mean, I feel most to least is a very conservative set of prompts, and people follow them very clearly. But with least to most, I feel like there's almost this wild westness of the prompt of like, this is what it should look like, but sort of do whatever, just as long as I get it right eventually. And I know too many people who've written it as like a self-correct, or they'd write it as a plus because eventually they got it right. And then you'd be dealing with this sort of like, oh God, are these people doing it wrong? And say what you will for, no, but we train our people well, and we do all these things really well, and we check our data really well. But that's just one more thing you now, as a supervisor, have to be wary of, have to be paying closer attention to. And everyone already is saying, there's too many things to pay close attention to, so why throw one more in if you can get a similar result with a most to least 2 second delay?
But even
agreed. Sold. Ooh. To Rob.
I don't know, because if you look at other research looking at the 2 second delay, I right now can't pull it up, but it's from that same research group that the 2 second delay most of the time is like a 5 second delay, that the 2 seconds is actually not 2 seconds, because people don't ever do the 1 1000 2 1000.
But now with our phones in our pockets, we've got timers galore.
And nobody uses them.
So I'm not gonna set a timer for 2 seconds,
right? So
I would tell them, set your timer for 2 seconds. Don't go on Facebook with that phone when you're done.
That fidelity could interesting. Yeah, so that's something to think about, though, right? Like, just know that your 2 seconds is probably going to be 5 seconds, and it might be too long.
Yeah, it sort of comes down to the
Jackie.
It sort of comes down to the, do you want everybody learning correctly, and potentially you're missing out on some speed
right.
benefits, or do you want to take advantage of those speed benefits and potentially be delaying the learning of a couple of your students? And there's not really a great answer, because you want everyone to be learning maximally effectively at all times.
Right.
It's a conundrum. I think given nothing at all, I would say most at least 2 seconds. I'd give that a shot and say that's my new starting point. And I would just, again, as the person who would be in charge of, you know, clinical decision making would really be paying close attention to my data on a regular basis. Although I suppose I could do that with most to least as well.
Yeah, you could.
I mean, I do with most. I mean, I have in the past.
No, but with a 2 second delay, you'll be able to see if there's independent responding occurring much sooner.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm for the 2 second delay for sure.
Okay.
I am too. I'm not trying to knock
Jack,
it.
You lost the argument. Go into the wasteland. You're out of Thunderdome.
I am all on board with the time delay. Just know that it's not going to be 2 seconds and be okay with that.
Okay.
I'm not okay with it.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty much okay with it.
I'll survive. I have no concept of time anyway.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
So true.
Robin's like, this is like 20 minutes. Robin's still not provided the prompt.
I can get anywhere in the state in 5 minutes. Don't worry.
No, you always say it's 20 minutes. We know where we're going. It's only 20 minutes.
Before we go on to the second half of our dissemination, I did want to make sure if you're listening to this episode for continuing education credits, you get our second secret code word, and it is leaves. L-E-A-V-E-S. Leaves.
Things you might be raking.
Or of grass.
You're going to make like a tree. Get out of here.
That's funny.
That's about as funny as a screen door on a battleship.
Don't understand. Anyway.
What does that mean? You're going to sink?
No, it's a screen door on a submarine is the saying.
Oh.
I sort of missed that one. Sorry.
It's from Back to the Future, a movie Jackie has not seen.
I know. Don't do it. I'm going to watch it. That's
what I'm gonna can't tell you that as a child, if you left the door open, then someone would say, were you born in a barn? And you'd say, only a mansion with swinging doors.
Which is hilarious because where I grew up, we never shut the doors. So maybe we did. Like, literally, my dad, even now, like, I have a mischievous dog. And when we go up there, I'm like, please shut the doors. It's like April and it's 40 degrees out and all the doors and windows are open. And he's like, I just don't like the doors. I run into them because they're glass. And I was like, we'll make them not glass. I don't have to worry he doesn't listen. But I mean, they're always open, and he'll, like, hold them open for hours, all day long, all night.
Bugs will get in.
I know. It's disgusting. We've had birds in our house. We've had raccoons. We've had squirrels. Yeah, it's like we live in the forest.
Perhaps you should use some no-no prompting.
No. Try again.
The door's open. Go, no.
See what happens.
And the dad will be like, grab a tea kettle. Right. No. Sing a song.
Go manually prompt him to shut the door.
So we agree we might change our most to least prompting to add that 2 second delay. No prompting. No or yes. That's my awesome headline.
No need more info.
Yeah.
Yeah. I need a little more research. I like it. It's promising, but I want some more.
Yeah, I want to keep an open mind, and I don't want to assume that just because that's not how I was trained to do things a million years ago, that I wouldn't change what I do. But at the same time, there's just so much about that prompt that it doesn't feel there's something about it. It doesn't feel right.
I mean, this is just me postulating, but I think it worked really well in this scenario because it was a two-choice array.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think the bigger take-home point that I should incorporate into my own practice is providing differential reinforcement for independent responding over prompted responding.
Yes.
I think that's the bigger piece.
I should do that more often, too. I also fall into the rut of the prompted, not prompted, or I reinforce everything regardless as long as the answer's right eventually. Yeah.
No, I think that slows
down acquisition.
Yeah.
So that's my take home.
Okay. That's a good – I think that might be the best take home given the information we have.
But bam, I won Thunderdome.
You did. You are the Master Blaster.
I never win.
It's okay, Jackie.
You don't need another prompting method. I can sing too.
Wow.
All right.
Thanks, guys, for listening to our singing.
All right. So we've taken home and disseminated all we're able to with our prompting articles. But yeah, mm-hmm. let's get that no prompt. Let's see how it does stacked up in some other training scenarios. I would be interested in that.
Totally.
If you do that research, please tell us, and we'll talk about it again in a follow-up episode.
Yeah, call us.
We could be in the authors because we totally suggested to do it. Therefore,
yeah,
we copyrighted the idea
on that article. Thanks.
Right.
Thanks to my friends at ABA Inside Track. You guys are so awesome. Thanks to Rob for his great song.
And Rob's got vocal fry right now. Thank you.
You can't help it.
You know, it happens.
He's so hipster.
That's right, dudes.
With your unbuttoned flannel shirt you have on right now. I mean, he's wearing a shirt underneath it. Sorry.
No, it's not.
My chest is just open. It's just to the elements.
You guys better watch our preview episode. Rob's just wearing a
flannel shirt. Is my
shirt
okay? No. Put another shirt on. What? What should I do? Take it all the way off.
No.
Put on some sort of a tank top. I don't know.
Where's that sailor hat?
That's got to be somewhere around here.
All right, guys.
Enough malarkey. Well, we've gotten to the malarkey episode portion of the show, so that means the episode is done.
Time to go.
Well, thanks everyone so much for listening to ABA Inside Track. Thank you so much, Jackie. Thank you so much, Diana,
for being
here.
You're welcome.
If you've enjoyed our show, we would really appreciate it if you subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can also find us online pretty much anywhere as ABA Inside Track. Our Facebook page is where we put most of our posts. We post the episodes. We also post links that we think you will find interesting and some different pictures that we hope you find amusing. Usually on Mondays we have that.
Monday.
If you'd like to email us with ideas for topics or just to say hi, you can email us at abainsidetrack@gmail.com. Well, everybody, I guess that's all we have time for. We'll be back next week with a preview episode of our next exciting topic. But until then, keep responding. Bye.
Bye now. Go to bed.